colleagues nor sought to gain credit amongst the great. Madame Dupin, not finding in Madame de Chenonceau all the docility which she expected from her, made her house very dull for her, and Madame de Chenonceau, proud of her own merits, and perhaps also of her birth, preferred to renounce the pleasures of society, and to remain almost alone in her room, than to bear a yoke, for which she felt she was not adapted. This species of exile increased my attachment for her, from the natural inclination which attracts me towards the unfortunate. I found in her a metaphysical and thoughtful mind, although at times somewhat sophistical. Her conversation, which was by no means that of a young woman just leaving the convent, was very attractive to me, and yet she was not 20 years of age. Her complexion was dazzlingly fair. Her figure would have been dignified and beautiful if she had carried herself better. Her hair, which was ashen grey and of rare beauty, reminded me of my dear mamma's in her youth, and caused a lovely emotion in my aunt. But the strict principles which I just laid down for myself, and which I was resolved to act up to at all cost, protected me against her and her charm. During the whole summer I spent 3 or 4 hours every day alone with her, solemnly teaching her arithmetic, and wearying her with my everlasting figures, without ever uttering a single word of gallantry or casting a glance of admiration upon her. 5 or 6 years later, I should have been neither so wise nor so foolish, but it was destined that I should only love truly once in my life, and that the first and last sighs of my heart should be given to another than her. Since I had lived at Madame Dupin's, I had always been satisfied with my lot, without showing any desire to see it improved. The increase in my salary, due to her and Monsieur de Francais together, was quite voluntary on their part. This year, Monsieur de Francais, whose friendship for me increased daily, wanted to make my position somewhat more comfortable and less precarious. He was Receiver General of Finance. Monsieur Dudoyer, his cashier, was old, well-to-do, and anxious to retire. Monsieur de Francais offered me his place, and in order to make myself fit to take it, I went for a few weeks to Monsieur Dudoyer's house to receive the necessary instructions. But whether it was that I had little talent for this occupation, or that Dudoyer, who seemed to me to have someone else in his eye as his successor, did not instruct me in good faith, my acquisition of the knowledge required was slow and unsatisfactory, and I was never able to get into my head the state of accounts, which perhaps had been purposely muddled. However, without having grasped the intricacies of the business, I soon acquired sufficient knowledge of its ordinary routine to undertake the general management. I even commenced its duties. I kept the ledgers and the cash. I paid and received money, and gave receipts. And although I had as little inclination as ability for such employment, advancing years made me more sensible. I determined to overcome my dislike, and to devote myself entirely to my duties. Unfortunately, just as I was beginning to get used to them, Monsieur de Francais went away on a short journey, during which I remained in charge of his cash, which, at that time, however, did not amount to more than 25,000 or 30,000 francs. The care and anxiety which this deposit caused me convinced me that I was not made for a cashier, and I have no doubt that the impatience with which I awaited his return contributed to the illness which subsequently attacked me. I have already mentioned in the first part of this work that I was almost dead when I was born. A defective formation of the bladder caused, during my childhood, an almost continual retention of urine, and my aunt Suzon, who took care of me, had the greatest difficulty in keeping me alive. However, she at length succeeded. My robust constitution at length gained the upper hand, and my health improved so much during my youth that, with the exception of the attack of languor, which I have described, and the frequent necessity of making water, which the least heating of the blood always rendered a matter of difficulty, I reached the age of 30 without feeling my early infirmity at all. The first touch of it which I had was on my arrival at Venice. The fatigue of the journey and the fearful heat which I had suffered brought on a constant desire to make water, and an affection of the kidneys, which lasted till the beginning of the winter. After my visit to the Paduana, I looked upon myself as a dead man, and yet I never suffered the slightest inconvenience from it. After having exhausted myself more in imagination than in reality for my Zulietta, I was in better health than ever. It was only after Diderot's confinement that the overheating caused by my journeys to Vincennes during the fearful heat brought on a violent pain in the kidneys, and since that time I have never recovered my health completely. At the time of which I am speaking, having perhaps overtired myself with my distasteful work at the confounded office, I became worse than before, and was confined to my bed for 5 or 6 weeks in the most melancholy condition that can be imagined. Madame Dupin sent the celebrated Morin to see me, who, in spite of his cleverness and delicacy of touch, caused me incredible suffering, and could never get to probe me. He advised me to consult Darin, who managed to introduce his bougies, which were more flexible, and afforded me some relief. But when giving Madame Dupin an account of my condition, he declared that I had less than 6 months to live. This verdict, which I afterwards heard, caused me to reflect seriously upon my condition, and upon the folly of sacrificing the repose and comfort of my few remaining days to the slavery of an employment for which I felt nothing but aversion. Besides, how could I reconcile the strict principles which I had just adopted with a situation which harmonized so ill with them? Would it not have been very bad taste in me, cashier of a receiver general of finance, to preach disinterestedness and poverty? These ideas fermented so strongly in my head, together with the fever, and combined so powerfully, that from that time nothing could uproot them, and during the period of my recovery I quietly determined to carry out the resolutions which I had made during my delirium. I renounced for ever all plans of fortune and promotion, resolved to pass my few remaining days in poverty and independence. I employed all my strength of mind in breaking away from the bonds of the opinion of the world, and in courageously carrying out everything which appeared to me to be right, without troubling myself about what the world might think of it. The obstacles which I had to overcome, the efforts which I made to triumph over them, are incredible. I succeeded as much as was possible, and more than I had myself hoped. If I had been as successful in shaking off the yoke of friendship as that of public opinion, I should have accomplished my purpose, perhaps the greatest, or at any rate the most conducive to virtue, that a mortal has ever conceived. But while I trampled underfoot the senseless judgments of the common herd of the so-called great and wise, I suffered myself to be subjugated and led like a child by so-called friends, who, jealous of seeing me strike out a new path by myself, thought of nothing but how to make me appear ridiculous, and began by doing their utmost to degrade me in order to raise an outcry against me. It was the change in my character, dating from this period, rather than my literary celebrity, that drew their jealousy upon me. They would perhaps have forgiven me for distinguishing myself in the art of writing, but they could not forgive me for setting an example in my change of life, which seemed likely to cause them inconvenience. I was born for friendship. My easy and gentle disposition found no difficulty in cherishing it. As long as I was unknown to the world, I was loved by all who knew me, and had not a single enemy. But as soon as I became known, I had not a single friend. This was a great misfortune. It was a still greater one that I was surrounded by people who called themselves my friends, and who only made use of the privileges which this name allowed them to drag me to my ruin. The sequel of these memoirs will reveal this odious intrigue. At present I only point out its origin. My readers will soon see the first link forged. In the state of independence in which I intended to live, it was necessary, however, to find means of subsistence. I bethought myself of a very simple plan, copying music at so much a page. If a more solid employment would have fulfilled the same end, I should have adopted it. But as I had taste and ability for this, and as it was the only occupation which would provide my daily bread without personal dependence, I was satisfied with it. Believing that I no longer had need of foresight, and silencing the voice of vanity, from cashier to a financier, I became a copyist of music. I thought I'd gained greatly by the choice, and I have so little regretted it that I have never abandoned this employment except under compulsion, and then only to resume it as soon as I was able. The success of my first essay made it easier for me to carry out this resolution. After it had gained the prize, Diderot undertook to get it printed. While I was in bed, he wrote me a note, informing me of its publication and the effect it had produced. "It has gone up like a rocket," he told me. "Such a success has never been seen before." This voluntary approval of the public, in the case of an unknown author, gave me the first real assurance of my ability, as to which, in spite of my inner feelings, I had until then always been doubtful. I saw the great advantage I might derive from it in view of the resolution which I was on the point of carrying out, and I judged that a copyist of some literary celebrity would not be likely to suffer from want of work. As soon as my resolution was taken and confirmed, I wrote a note to Monsieur de Francais to inform him of it, thanking him and Madame Dupin for all their kindness, and asking for their custom. Francais, quite unable to understand the note, and believing that I was still delirious, came to me in all haste. But he found my mind so firmly made up that he was unable to shake my resolution. He went and told Madame Dupin and everyone else that I'd gone mad. I let him do so, and went my way. I commenced my reformation with my dress. I gave up my gold lace and white stockings, and put on a round wig. I took off my sword and sold my watch, saying to myself with incredible delight, "Thank heaven I shall not want to know the time again." Monsieur de Francais was kind enough to wait some time before he found a successor to me. At last, when he saw that my mind was made up, he gave my post to Monsieur Dalibard, formerly tutor to the young Chenonceau, known in the botanical world for his Flora Parisiensis. I have no doubt that Francais and his associates now give a totally different account of all this, but I appeal to what he said about it at the time, and for a long time afterwards to all his acquaintances, until the conspiracy was formed. Men of good sense and honour cannot have forgotten his words. In spite of the strictness of my sumptuary reform, I did not at first extend it to my linen, which was good, and of which I had a large stock, the remains of my Venetian outfit, and for which I had a special fondness. I had considered it so much a matter of cleanliness that I ended by making it a matter of luxury, which was certainly expensive. Someone was kind enough to deliver me from this servitude on Christmas Eve while the women folk were at Vespers, and I was at the spiritual concert, at which only religious music was heard, and which on certain days was a substitute for secular concerts. The door of a garret in which all our linen was hung up after a wash, which was just finished, was broken open. Everything was stolen, amongst other things, 42 fine linen shirts belonging to me, the principal part of my linen wardrobe. From the description given by the neighbours of a man who had been seen to leave the hotel carrying some bundles, Thérèse and myself suspected her brother, who was known to be a worthless fellow. The mother indignantly repudiated the suspicion, but it was confirmed by so many proofs that we could not abandon it, in spite of her indignation. I did not venture to make strict inquiries for fear of discovering more than I might have liked. The brother never showed himself again, and at last disappeared altogether. I deplored Thérèse's misfortune and my own in being connected with so mixed a family, and I urged her more strongly than ever to shake off a yoke so dangerous. This adventure cured me of my passion for fine linen, and from that time I've only worn shirts of very common material, more in keeping with the rest of my dress. Having thus completed my reforms, my only anxiety was to make them solid and lasting, by doing my utmost to root out of my heart everything which was still liable to be affected by public opinion. everything which, from fear of censure, might turn me aside from that which was good and reasonable in itself. In consequence of the stir which my essay created, my resolution also made a sensation and brought me employment, so that I commenced my new profession with tolerable success. Nevertheless, several causes prevented me from succeeding as well as I might have done in other circumstances. In the first place, my bad health. My recent attack left after effects which prevented me from ever regaining my former state of health. And it is my belief that the physicians, to whose treatment I entrusted myself, did me as much harm as my illness. I consulted, in succession, Morin, Darin, Helvetius, Malouin, and Thierry, all very learned men, and my personal friends. Each treated me in his own way, afforded me no relief, and considerably weakened me. The more I submitted to their treatment, the yellower, thinner, and weaker I became. My imagination, which they terrified, judged of my condition by the effects of their drugs, and only set before my eyes a continuous succession of sufferings before my death, retention of urine, gravel, and stone. All the remedies which afford relief to others, ptisans, baths, and bleeding, only aggravated my sufferings. Finding that Darin's bougies, the only ones which had any effect, and without which I thought I could not live, only afforded me momentary relief, I proceeded at great expense to lay in an enormous stock of them, so that, in case of Darin's death, I might always have some for use. During the 8 or 10 years in which I made such constant use of them, I must have spent at least 50 louis. It will be readily imagined that a treatment so expensive, painful, and troublesome distracted me from my work, and that a dying man is not very eager about earning his daily bread. Literary occupations were equally prejudicial to my daily work. No sooner had my essay appeared than the defenders of literature fell upon me as if by common consent. Indignant at the sight of so many Messieurs Josse, who did not even understand the question, attempting to decide like masters, I took up my pen and treated some of them in such a manner that they no longer had the laugh on their side. Monsieur Josse was one of the characters in Molière's L'Amour Médecin. The saying, "Vous êtes orfèvre, Monsieur Josse," is used to remind a man that he is personally interested in the success of anything which he strongly recommends or supports. One Monsieur Gautier from Nancy, the first who fell under my lash, was roughly abused in a letter to Grimm. The second was King Stanislaus himself, who did not disdain to enter the lists with me. The honour which he did me obliged me to change the tone of my answer. I adopted one that was more serious, but equally emphatic, and without failing in respect towards the author, I completely refuted his work. I knew that a Jesuit, Father Manu, had had a hand in it. I trusted to my judgment to distinguish the work of the prince from that of the monk, and, mercilessly attacking all the Jesuitical phrases, I brought into prominence, as I went along, an anachronism which I believed could only have proceeded from the pen of his reverence. This composition, which for some reason or other has made less stir than my other writings, is in its way unique. In it I seized the opportunity of showing the public how a private individual could defend the cause of truth, even against a sovereign. It would be difficult to adopt, at the same time, a more dignified and respectful tone than that which I adopted in my answer to him. I was fortunate enough to have to deal with an adversary for whom I felt sincere esteem, which I could exhibit without servile adulation. This I did with tolerable success, and always in a dignified manner. My friends, alarmed on my behalf, thought they already saw me in the Bastille. I never once had any such fear, and I was right. This worthy prince, after he had seen my reply, said, "I've had enough of it. I will have nothing more to do with it." Since then I have received from him various marks of esteem and kindness, some of which I shall have to mention presently, and my composition quietly circulated throughout France and Europe, without anyone finding anything in it to censure. Shortly afterwards I had another opponent, whom I had not expected, the same Monsieur Borde of Lyon, who 10 years previously had shown me much friendship, and rendered me several services. I had not forgotten him, but had neglected him from simple laziness, and I had not sent him my writings, since I had had no convenient opportunity of getting them delivered to him. I was wrong. He attacked me, certainly with politeness, and I answered in the same tone. He made a more decided rejoinder, which drew from me a final answer, after which he remained silent. But he became my most violent enemy, profited by the time of my misfortunes to write a most fearful libel against me, and took a journey to London on purpose to do me harm there. All these polemics took up a great deal of my time, which was lost to my copying, without any advantage to the cause of truth, or profit to my purse. Pissot, who was my publisher at the time, gave me very little for my brochures, and often nothing at all. For instance, I never received a sou for my first essay. Diderot gave it to him for nothing. I was obliged to wait a long time and extract the little remuneration which he gave me, sou by sou. In the meantime, my copying was a failure. I carried on two trades, which was the way to fail in both. They were contradictory in another way, the different mode of life which they forced me to adopt. The success of my first writings had made me the fashion. The position which I had taken up aroused curiosity. People were anxious to make the acquaintance of the singular man who sought no one's society, and whose only anxiety was to live free and happy after his own fashion. This was sufficient to make this an impossibility for him. My room was never free from people who, under different pretexts, came to rob me of my time. Ladies employed 1,000 artifices to get me to dine with them. The more I offended people, the more obstinate they became. I could not refuse everybody. While I made 1,000 enemies by my refusals, I was incessantly a slave to my desire to oblige, and however I managed, I never had an hour to myself during the day. I then discovered that it is by no means so easy as one imagines to be poor and independent. I wanted to live by my profession. The public would not have it. They invented 1,000 ways of indemnifying me for the time which they made me lose. Presents of all kinds were always being sent to me. Soon I should have been obliged to show myself like Punch at so much a head. I know no slavery more cruel and degrading than that. I saw no remedy for it, except to refuse all presents, great and small, and to make no exception in favour of anyone. The only effect of this was to increase the number of the donors, who desired to have the honour of overcoming my resistance, and of compelling me to be under an obligation to them in spite of myself. Many, who would not have given me a crown if I had asked for it, never ceased to importune me with their offers, and to avenge themselves when they found them rejected, charged me with arrogance and ostentation, in consequence of my refusal. It will easily be understood that the resolution which I had taken, and the system which I desired to follow, were not at all to the liking of Madame Levasseur. All the daughter's disinterestedness was unable to prevent her from following the instructions of her mother, and the gouverneurs, as Grimm used to call them, were not always as firm in their refusal as I was. Although many things were concealed from me, I saw enough to convince me that I did not see everything, and this tormented me, not so much on account of the charge of connivance, which I readily foresaw would be made, as by the cruel thought that I could never be master of my own household, or even of myself. I begged, entreated, and got angry. All in vain. Mamma gave me the reputation of an eternal grumbler and a surly boor. Continual whisperings with my friends went on. All was mystery and secrecy in my household, and, to avoid exposing myself to perpetual storms, I no longer ventured to make inquiries about what was going on. To deliver myself from all this disturbance would have needed a firmness of which I was incapable. I knew how to make a noise, but not how to act. They allowed me to speak and went their way. These continual upsets and the daily importunities to which I was subjected at length made my apartments and my stay at Paris very unpleasant. When my ill health permitted me to go out, and I did not allow myself to be dragged hither and thither by my acquaintances, I used to go for a solitary walk, during which, dreaming of my grand system, I jotted down some ideas on paper with the aid of a pocket-book and pencil, which I always carried about with me. In this manner, the unforeseen unpleasantnesses of a condition which I had chosen for myself threw me entirely into a literary career, by way of escaping from them. And this is the reason why, in all my early works, I introduced the bitterness and ill-humour which caused me to write them. Another circumstance contributed to this. Thrown, in spite of myself, into the great world, without possessing its manners, and unable to acquire or conform to them, I took it into my head to adopt manners of my own, which might enable me to dispense with them. Being unable to overcome my foolish and disagreeable shyness, which proceeded from the fear of offending against the rules of polite society, I resolved, in order to give myself courage, to trample them underfoot. Shame made me cynical and sarcastic. I affected to despise the politeness which I did not know how to practice. It is true that this rudeness, in harmony with my new principles, became ennobled in my mind, and assumed the form of dauntless virtue. And on this lofty basis, I venture to assert, it supported itself longer and more successfully than would naturally have been expected from an effort so contrary to my disposition. However, in spite of the reputation for misanthropy which my outward appearance and some happy remarks gained for me in the world, it is certain that, in private, I always sustained my part badly. My friends and acquaintances led this unsociable bear like a lamb, and, limiting my sarcasms to unpalatable but general truths, I was never capable of saying a single discourteous word to anyone whatsoever. The devin du village made me quite the fashion, and soon there was not a man in Paris more sought after than myself. The history of this piece, which was an epoch in my life, is mixed up with that of the connections which I had formed at that time. In order that the sequel may be rightly understood, I must enter into details. I had a tolerably large number of acquaintances, but only two chosen friends, Diderot and Grimm. Owing to the desire which I always feel to bring together all who are dear to me, I was so devoted a friend of both that it was unavoidable that they should soon become equally devoted to each other. I brought them together. They suited each other, and soon became more intimate with each other than with me. Diderot had acquaintances without number, but Grimm, being a foreigner and a newcomer, had his to make. I desired nothing better than to assist him. I had introduced him to Diderot. I introduced him to Gaufrecourt. I took him to Madame de Chenonceau, to Madame d'Epinay, to the Baron d'Holbach, with whom I found myself connected, almost in spite of myself. All my friends became his. That was simple enough. But none of his ever became mine. This was not so intelligible. While he lived with the Comte de Frieres, he often invited us to dine with him. But I've never received any proof of friendship from the Comte de Frieres, or the Comte de Schomberg, his relative, who was very intimate with Grimm, or from any other person, male or female, with whom Grimm had any connection through their means. The only exception was the Abbé Raynal, who, although his friend, also proved himself mine, and when I needed it, placed his purse at my disposal with a rare generosity. But I had known the Abbé long before Grimm himself, and I'd always entertained a great regard for him, since he had behaved to me in a most delicate and honourable manner, in a matter certainly of little importance, but which I never forgot. The Abbé Raynal was certainly a warm friend. He gave me a proof of this about this time, in a matter that concerned Grimm, with whom he was very intimate. Grim, after having long been on very friendly terms with Mademoiselle Fell, suddenly took it into his head to conceive a violent passion for her, and wanted to supplant Cahusac. The young lady, priding herself upon her constancy, showed her new admirer the door. The latter took the matter in a tragic light, and had a fancy that it would be his death. He suddenly began to suffer from the strangest illness that has perhaps ever been heard of. He passed days and nights in a state of continued lethargy, his eyes wide open, his pulse regular, but without speaking, eating, or stirring, sometimes seeming to hear, but never answering, even by signs. In other respects he was free from agitation, pain, or fever, and lay as if he had been dead. The Abbé Raynal and myself took it in turns to watch him, the Abbé being stronger and in better health by night, and myself by day. He was never left alone, and neither of us ever quitted him before the other had come to take his place. The Comte de Fries, being alarmed about him, brought Senac to see him, who, after a careful examination, declared that there was nothing the matter with the patient, and did not even prescribe for him. My anxiety about my friend made me carefully observe the physician's countenance, and I saw him smile as he left the room. Nevertheless, Grimm remained for several days without moving, without taking broth or anything else, except some preserved cherries which I laid upon his tongue from time to time, and which he eagerly swallowed. One fine morning he got up, dressed himself, and resumed his ordinary occupations, without ever saying anything, either to me or, as far as I know, to the Abbé, or anyone else, about this singular lethargy, or of the attention and care which we had bestowed upon him as long as it lasted. This adventure, nevertheless, made a considerable stir, and it would really have been a wonderful story if the cruelty of an opera girl had caused a man to die of despair. This violent passion made Grimm the rage. He was soon looked upon as a prodigy of love, friendship, and devotion in every respect. This reputation caused him to be run after and feted in the great world, which separated him from me, who had never been anything to him but a makeshift. I saw that he was on the point of being entirely estranged from me. This was very distressing to me, for all the lively feelings, of which he made such a show, were just those which I entertained for him, although I did not make such a noise about it. I was glad that he should succeed in the world, but I should have wished him to do so without, at the same time, forgetting his friend. I said to him one day, "Grimm, you are neglecting me. I forgive you. When the first intoxication of noisy success has produced its effect, and you begin to perceive its emptiness, I hope that you will come back to me. You will always find me the same. For the present, do not put yourself out. I leave you to do as you please, and will wait for you." He told me that I was right, made his arrangements accordingly, and went his own way so completely that I only saw him in the company of our mutual friends. Our chief meeting-place, before he became so closely connected with Madame d'Epinay, was the Baron d'Holbach's house. This Baron was the son of a self-made man, who possessed an ample fortune, which he used nobly. He received at his house men of letters and learning, and by his own knowledge and accomplishments, was well able to hold his own amongst them. Having been long intimate with Diderot, he had sought my acquaintance through him, even before my name became known. A natural repugnance for a long time prevented me from meeting his advances. One day he asked me the reason, and I said to him, "You are too wealthy." He persisted, and finally prevailed. My greatest misfortune has ever been inability to resist flattery, and I have always regretted yielding to it. Another acquaintance, which ripened into friendship as soon as I had a reason to claim it, was that of Monsieur Duclos. Several years had elapsed since I had seen him, for the first time, at La Chevrette, at the house of Madame d'Epinay, with whom he was on intimate terms. We only dined together, and he returned the same day, but we conversed for a few moments after dinner. Madame d'Epinay had spoken to him of me and my opera of Les Muses Galantes. Duclos, who was gifted with too great talent himself not to value those who possessed it, became prepossessed in my favour, and had invited me to go and see him. In spite of my early inclination, which was strengthened by acquaintance, my timidity and want of energy kept me back as long as I had no other passport to him except his courtesy. But, encouraged by my first success and his praises, which were repeated to me, I went to call upon him, and he returned my call. In this manner commenced the connection between us, which will always cause me to regard him with affection, and to which, as well as the testimony of my own heart, I owe the knowledge that uprightness and honour may sometimes be combined with literary culture. Many other connections, less lasting, which I here pass over, were the result of my early successes, and continued until curiosity was satisfied. I was a man who was so soon understood that, after the first day, there was nothing more to be seen in me. One lady, however, who at that time sought my acquaintance, was more constant to me than any of the rest. This was Madame la Marquise de Crequy, niece of the Bailli de Franley, the Maltese ambassador, whose brother had preceded Monsieur de Montaigu in the embassy at Venice, and whom I had gone to see on my return from that city. Madame de Crequy wrote to me. I called upon her, and she conceived a friendship for me. I sometimes dined at her house, where I met several men of letters, amongst others Monsieur Saurin, the author of Spartacus, Barnevelt, and other works, who afterwards became my bitterest enemy, for no other reason that I can imagine, except that I bear the name of a man whom his father had persecuted disgracefully. It will be seen that, for a copyist who ought to be occupied with his business from morning till evening, I had numerous distractions, which prevented my daily work from being very lucrative, and myself from paying sufficient attention to what I had to do, for me to do it well. I thus lost more than half the time I had left in erasing or scratching out mistakes, or beginning my work again on a fresh sheet of paper. This constant interruption made Paris daily more intolerable to me, and I eagerly seized every opportunity of going into the country. I went several times to spend a few days at Marcoussi, where Madame Levasseur knew the vicar, at whose house we so arranged matters that he found himself at no disadvantage. Once, Grimm went with us. Since I have here omitted to mention a trifling but memorable adventure which I had with the aforesaid Grimm, one morning when we were to dine at the fountain of Saint-Ventrille, I will not return to it, but on subsequent reflection I concluded that, in the bottom of his heart, he was brooding over the conspiracy which he afterwards carried out with such marvellous success. The vicar had a good voice and sang well, and although not a musician, could learn his part with ease and accuracy. We spent the time in singing the trios which I had composed at Chenonceaux. I also wrote two or three new ones, to the words which Grimm and the vicar put together as well as they could. I cannot help regretting these trios, which were written and sung in moments of pure joy, and which I have left at Wootton with all my music. Mademoiselle Davenport has perhaps already made curl papers of them, but they were worth preserving, and are mostly written in a very good counterpoint. It was after one of these little excursions, when I was delighted to see Aunt at her ease and very cheerful, and had also enjoyed myself very much, that I wrote to the vicar a letter in verse, hastily dashed off, and a very poor composition, which will be found amongst my papers. Nearer Paris I found another place of refuge, very much to my taste, with Monsieur Moussard, a countryman, relative, and friend, who had made a charming retreat for himself at Passy, where I have spent many peaceful moments. Monsieur Moussard was a jeweller, a man of good sense, who, after having made a comfortable fortune in his business, married his only daughter to Monsieur de Valmalette, the son of an exchange broker, and maître d'hôtel to the king, and prudently left trade and business in his old age, in order to enjoy an interval of repose and enjoyment, between the worries of life and his death. The worthy Moussa, a real practical philosopher, lived, free from cares, in a very nice house which he'd built for himself, standing in a very pretty garden which he'd planted with his own hands. While digging up the terraces of his garden, he found fossil shells in such quantities that his lively imagination saw nothing but shells in the natural world, and he at last sincerely believed that the universe consisted of nothing but shells and remains of shells, and that the whole earth was nothing but so much shell sand. Thinking of nothing but this fact and his wonderful discoveries, he became so excited with these ideas that they would soon have turned to a system in his head, that is to say, to madness, had not death, fortunately for his reason, but unfortunately for his friends, who were much attached to him, and found at his house a most agreeable refuge, removed him from them by a most strange and painful disease. This was a constantly growing tumour in the stomach, which for a long time prevented him from eating before the reason was discovered, and which, after several years of suffering, caused his death from sheer starvation. I can never recall without the greatest anguish the last days of this unfortunate and worthy man, who still heartily welcomed Len Yeps and myself, the only friends whom the sight of the sufferings which he endured did not drive away from him until his last hour, who, as I say, was reduced to devouring with his eyes the repast which he caused to be set before us, scarcely able to swallow a few drops of weak tea, which he was obliged to bring up the next moment. But before these days of suffering, how many agreeable hours did I spend at his house with the select circle of his friends? At the head of these I placed the Abbé Prévost, an amiable and simple person, whose heart inspired his writings, which deserved to be immortalized, and who, neither in his disposition nor in society, showed any traces of the sombre colouring which characterized his works. Procope, the physician, a little Aesop, who was a great ladies' man. Boulanger, the famous posthumous author of Le Despotisme Oriental, and who, I believe, extended Moussa's theories on the age of the world. Amongst his lady friends were Madame Denis, Voltaire's niece, who at that time was simple and unaffected, and made no pretense to be a wit. Madame Vanloo, who was certainly no beauty, but was charming and sang like an angel. And Madame de Valmalette herself, who also sang, and who, although very thin, would have been very amiable if she'd made less pretense of being so. These made up nearly the whole of Monsieur Moussa's friends. Their society would have been very agreeable to me, had not his conchylomania been even more agreeable, and I can say that for 6 months or more I worked in his study with as much pleasure as himself. He had for a long time insisted that the waters of Passy would be beneficial to me, and strongly advised me to come to his house and drink them. In order to get away from the noisy crowd of the city for a little while, I at last gave in, and spent 8 or 10 days at Passy, which did me more good because I was in the country than because I took the waters. Moussa played the violoncello, and was passionately fond of Italian music. One evening we had a long conversation about it before going to bed, especially about the opera buffa, which we had both seen in Italy, and with which we had both been delighted. During the night, being unable to sleep, I began to ponder how it would be possible to give an idea of this kind of drama in France, for the Amour de Rajonde had not the least resemblance to it. In the morning, while walking and drinking the waters, I hastily made up a few specimens of verse, and set them to the airs which came into my head as I composed them. I scribbled down the whole in a kind of vaulted salon at the top of the garden, and at tea I could not refrain from showing these airs to Moussa and Mademoiselle Duvernoy, his housekeeper, who was really a most excellent and amiable young woman. The three pieces which I had sketched were the first monologue, J'ai perdu mon serviteur, the air of the Devin du Village, L'amour croit s'il s'inquiète, and the last duet, A jamais, Colin, je t'engage, etc. I so little thought that it was worth the trouble of going on with it that, had it not been for the applause and encouragement of both, I should have thrown my scraps of paper into the fire and thought nothing more about it, as I had often done with other pieces which were at least as good. But I felt so encouraged that in 6 days my drama was finished, with the exception of a few lines, and all the music sketched out, so that I had nothing more to do in Paris, except to add a little recitative, and fill up the tenor parts. I finished the whole so quickly, that in 3 weeks my scenes were copied out fairly and fit for representation. The only thing remaining was the divertissement, which was not composed until a long time afterwards. 1752. The composition of this work had so excited me that I had a great desire to hear it, and I would have given all I possessed to have seen it performed, as I should have liked, with closed doors, as Lully is said to have once had Armide perform before himself alone. As it was not possible for me to enjoy this pleasure except in company with the public, I was obliged to get my piece accepted at the opera in order to hear it. Unfortunately, it was in a style entirely new, to which the ears of the public were quite unaccustomed. And besides, the failure of the Muse Galante made me expect the like for the Devin, if I presented it in my own name. Duclos helped me out of the difficulty, and undertook to get the piece tried without disclosing the author. To avoid betraying myself, I did not attend the rehearsal, and the little violins themselves, who conducted, were ignorant of the composer's name, until the general approval had attested the excellence of the work. The little violins were the names given to Rebelle and Francoeur, who from their youth had been in the habit of going from house to house to play the violin. All who heard it were so delighted that the next day nothing else was talked of in all circles. Monsieur de Curie, manager of court entertainments, who had been present at the rehearsal, asked for the piece, in order that it might be performed at court. Duclos, who knew my intentions, and thought that I should have less control over my piece at the court than in Paris, refused to deliver it. Curie demanded it by virtue of his office. Duclos persisted in his refusal, and the dispute between them became so lively that one day, at the opera, they would have gone out together to fight a duel, unless they had been separated. Curie wanted to treat with me. I left the decision with Duclos, and Curie was obliged to apply again to him. Monsieur le Duc d'Aumont interfered. At length Duclos thought it right to yield to authority, and the piece was given up in order to be played at Fontainebleau. The part to which I had devoted most attention, and in which I had made the greatest departure from the beaten track, was the recitative. Mine was accented in an entirely new manner, and kept time with the delivery of the words. This is débit, a term specially applied to the manner in which a recitative is sung. This horrible innovation was not allowed to stand, for fear of shocking the ears of those who followed each other like a flock of sheep. I consented that Franqueuil and Géliot should compose another recitative, but I refused to have anything to do with it myself. When everything was ready and the day fixed for the performance, it was proposed to me that I should take a journey to Fontainebleau to be present at the last rehearsal, at any rate. I went, with Mademoiselle Fell, Grimm, and I think the Abbé Raynal, in one of the royal carriages. The rehearsal was tolerable. I was better satisfied with it than I'd expected to be. The orchestra was a powerful one, consisting of those of the opera and the royal band. Géliot played Colin, Mademoiselle Fell, Colette, Cuvitier, the Devin, soothsayer. The choruses were from the opera. I said little. Géliot had arranged everything, and I did not desire to have any control over his arrangements. But in spite of my Roman air, I was as bashful as a schoolboy amongst all these people. On the following day, when the rehearsal was to take place, I went to breakfast at the Café du Grand Commune, which was full of people, talking about the rehearsal of the previous evening, and the difficulty there had been in getting in. An officer who was present said that he'd found no difficulty, gave a long account of the proceedings, described the author, and related what he had said and done. But what astounded me most in his long description, given with equal confidence and simplicity, was that there was not a word of truth in it. It was perfectly clear to me that the man who spoke so positively about this rehearsal had never been present, since he had before his eyes the author, whom he pretended he had observed so closely, and did not recognize him. The most remarkable thing about this incident was the effect which it produced upon me. This man was somewhat advanced in years. There was nothing of the coxcomb or swaggerer about him, either in his manner or tone. His countenance was intelligent, while his cross of Saint Louis showed that he was an old officer. In spite of his unblushing effrontery, in spite of myself, he interested me. While he retailed his lies, I blushed, cast down my eyes, and was on thorns. I sometimes asked myself whether it might not be possible to think that he was mistaken, and really believed what he said. At last, trembling for fear that someone might recognize me and put him to shame, I hurriedly finished my chocolate without saying a word, and holding my head down as I passed him, I left the café as soon as possible, while the company were discussing his description of what had taken place. In the street I found that I was bathed in perspiration, and I'm certain that if anyone had recognized and addressed me by name before I left, I should have exhibited all the shame and embarrassment of a guilty person, simply from the feeling of humiliation which the poor fellow would have experienced if his lies had been detected. I now come to one of the critical moments of my life, in which it is difficult to confine myself to simple narrative, because it is almost impossible to prevent even the narrative bearing the stamp of censure or apology. However, I will attempt to relate how and from what motives I acted, without adding an expression of praise or blame. On that day, I was dressed in my usual careless style, with a beard of some day's growth, and a badly combed wig. Considering this want of good manners as a proof of courage, I entered the hall, where the king, the queen, the royal family, and the whole court were presently to arrive. I proceeded to take my seat in the box to which Monsieur de Coury conducted me. It was his own, a large stage box, opposite a smaller and higher one, where the king sat with Madame de Pompadour. Surrounded by ladies, and the only man in front of the box, I had no doubt that I'd been put there on purpose to be seen. When the theatre was lighted up, and I found myself, dressed in the manner I was, in the midst of people almost elegantly attired, I began to feel ill at ease. I asked myself whether I was in my right place, and whether I was suitably dressed. After a few moments of uneasiness, I answered, "Yes," with a boldness which perhaps was due rather to the impossibility of drawing back than to the force of my arguments. I said to myself, I am in my place, since I'm going to see my own piece performed, because I have been invited, because I composed it solely for that purpose. Because, after all, no one has more right than myself to enjoy the fruit of my labour and talents. I am dressed as usual, neither better nor worse. If I again begin to yield to public opinion in any single thing, I shall soon become its slave again in everything. To be consistent, I must not be ashamed, wherever I may be, to be dressed in accordance with the condition of life which I have chosen for myself. My outward appearance is simple and careless, but not dirty or slovenly. A beard in itself is not so, since it is bestowed upon us by nature, and according to times and fashions, is sometimes even an ornament. People will consider me ridiculous, impertinent. Well, what does it matter to me? I must learn how to put up with ridicule and censure, provided they are not deserved. After this little soliloquy, I felt so encouraged that I should have behaved with intrepidity if it had been necessary. But whether it was the effect of the presence of the ruler or the natural disposition of those near me, I saw nothing in the curiosity of which I was the object except civility and politeness. This so affected me that I began to be uneasy again about myself and the fate of my piece. and to fear that I might destroy the favourable impressions which showed only an inclination to applaud me. I was armed against their raillery, but their kindly attitude, which I had not expected, so completely overcame me that I trembled like a child when the performance began. I soon found I had no reason for uneasiness. The piece was very badly acted, but the singing was good, and the music well executed. From the first scene, which is really touching in its simplicity, I heard in the boxes a murmur of surprise and applause hitherto unheard of at similar performances. The growing excitement soon reached such a height that it communicated itself to the whole audience, and, in the words of Montesquieu, the very effect increased the effect. In the scene between the two good little people, this effect reached its highest point. There is never any clapping when the king is present. This allowed everything to be heard, and the piece and the author were thereby benefited. I heard around me women, who seemed to me as beautiful as angels, whispering and saying to each other in a low tone, "Charming, delightful, every note speaks to the heart." The pleasure of affecting so many amiable persons moved me to tears, which I was unable to restrain during the first duet, when I observed that I was not the only one who wept. For a moment I felt anxious when I recalled the concert at Monsieur de Tréthoron's. This reminiscence produced upon me the same effect as the slave who held the crown over the head of a Roman general in his triumphal procession. But it did not last long, and I soon abandoned myself, completely and without reserve, to the delight of tasting the sweets of my success. And yet I am sure that at this moment I was much more affected by sensual impulse than by the vanity I felt as an author. If none but men had been present, I am convinced that I should not have been consumed, as I was, by the incessant desire of catching with my lips the delightful tears which I caused to flow. I have seen pieces excite more lively transports of admiration, but never so complete, so delightful, and so moving an intoxication, which completely overcame the audience, especially at a first performance before the court. Those who saw it on this occasion can never have forgotten it, for the effect was unique. The same evening, Monsieur le Duc d'Aumont sent word to me to present myself at the chateau on the following day at 11 o'clock, when he would present me to the king. Monsieur de Coury, who brought me the message, added that he believed that it was a question of a pension, the bestowal of which the king desired to announce to me in person. Will it be believed that the night which succeeded so brilliant a day was for me a night of anguish and perplexity? My first thought after that of this presentation was a certain necessity which had greatly troubled me on the evening of the performance, and had frequently obliged me to retire, and might trouble me again on the next day, in the gallery or the king's apartments, amongst all the great people while waiting for his majesty to pass. This infirmity was the chief cause which prevented me from going into society, or from staying in a room with ladies when the doors were closed. The mere idea of the situation in which this necessity might place me was enough to affect me to such an extent that it made me feel ready to faint, unless I should be willing to create a scandal, to which I should have preferred death. Only those who know what this condition is can imagine the horror of running the risk of it. I next pictured myself in the king's presence, and presented to his majesty, who condescended to stop and speak to me. On such an occasion, tact and presence of mind were indispensable in answering. Would my accursed timidity, which embarrasses me in the presence of the most ordinary stranger, abandon me when I found myself in the presence of the King of France? Would it suffer me to select, on the spur of the moment, the proper answer? It was my desire, without abandoning the austerity of tone and manner which I had assumed, to show that I was sensible of the honour which so great a monarch bestowed upon me. It was necessary that I should convey some great and useful truth in words of well-selected and well-deserved eulogy. To be able to prepare a happy answer beforehand, it would have been necessary to know exactly what he might say to me, and even had this been possible, I felt perfectly certain that I should not be able to recollect in his presence a single word of all that I had previously thought over. What would become of me at this moment, before the eyes of all the court, if, in my embarrassment, some of my usual silly utterances were to escape my lips? This danger alarmed, frightened, and made me tremble so violently that I resolved, at all hazards, not to expose myself to it. I lost, it is true, the pension, which was in a manner offered to me, but at the same time I escaped the yoke which it would have imposed upon me. Adieu, truth, liberty, and courage! How could I from that time forth have dared to speak of independence and disinterestedness? I could only flatter or keep my mouth closed if I accepted this pension. And besides, who would guarantee the payment of it? What steps should I have had to take? How many people I should have been obliged to solicit? It would have cost me more trouble and far more unpleasantness to keep it than to do without it. Consequently, in renouncing all thoughts of it, I believed that I was acting in a manner quite consistent with my principles, and sacrificing the appearance to the reality. I communicated my resolution to Grimm, who had nothing to say against it. To others I alleged my ill health as an excuse, and I left the same morning. My departure caused some stir, and was generally censured. My reasons could not be appreciated by everybody. It was much easier to accuse me of a foolish pride, and this more readily allayed the jealousy